welcome to Killer Crossroads, and this is episode 12. So I'm Linda, and joining me is my co-host in wine and crime, Josh. Welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing pretty good. We had an eventful day today.
That's right. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter. Where's my basket, honey?
Hey, I didn't get a basket either, but Akira did. Or he got a little bag of treats. Yeah, a little bag of treats. We got to get something for Bear and Leo, too.
We do. I didn't think about it. A bed for mom.
We'll get him something. We're going to give him that little Easter egg cat scratcher we saw.
Oh, yeah. And they have, like, what, 30 little trucks in the apartment?
Yep.
Little scratchers.
Yeah. They got a whole little village, a whole little garage of different vehicles, actually. Not a village, but a garage.
Well, we hope everyone had fun.
We do,
yes. Ate a lot. Get back to the grind tomorrow.
Unfortunately, but yeah. So for today's episode, we have two new stories again. Linda will be talking about an incident that happened in Oklahoma revolving around the murders of a couple Girl Scouts.
Yes, it happened in 1977.
Also, it happened
a while throwback.
Back. Okay. Well, interesting to hear about that. And I will be discussing a rather large conspiracy. I'm not sure if you've heard of the Finders and who they were, but I'm going to discuss them and their cult-like activities, which may or may not be or have some type of relationship within the CIA. It's a big conspiracy, and I've just now recently found out about this a bit more in depth, and it's shocking to me.
Yeah, one of our listeners actually made the suggestion, so we appreciate it.
Yeah.
So I'll kick things off with talking about the Girl Scout murder, so I'm not sure if you ever heard of this story.
I haven't.
Or this case.
I have not, no.
Okay, so did you ever go to like summer camp when you were younger?
Fortunately, I didn't.
Really?
No.
Me and my brother went to summer camp through church.
Okay.
Back in the day. And so, like, we would go and, like, go to field trips and, like, do extracurricular activities, like play basketball, do arts and crafts.
Well, that'd be nice.
But I feel like when you go to camp, you just think like you're gonna like just great things are gonna happen and you're excited and nervous, like you're gonna meet new people.
I'm sure as a kid, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
New activities.
But so on June 12th, 1977, things changed.
Okay.
So on this day, about 140 young girls arrived at Camp Scott in Locust Grove, Oklahoma, for a 2-week stay. So their parents let them go, and they had permission, and so now they had counselors on campgrounds.
Okay.
The Camp Scott is on a 410 acre that lies between Snake Creek and Spring Creek. The camp is run by the Girl Scouts, and it's been run by them since 1928. So on the first day of camp, there was a heavy thunderstorm, and it forced all the girls to stay inside their tents. So it's kind of unknown as to if each tent had an actual camp counselor, which I was confused about.
Okay.
Because when I think about camp, you have to be supervised, and then some, like an adult has to be in the area. But I think if you're in a tent, there should be someone in there with you. Like, how can you let kids stay in the tent by themselves? Because in all the research that I did, I did not find anything that said that there was like a counselor inside.
How old were the kids?
They ranged for, I think the youngest one was actually 8 years old.
Eight.
So I believe it was like anywhere from like 8 to 13.
Okay. I guess I would imagine there wouldn't be an actual counselor in the tent. So actually, I would think maybe that there's actually one counselor who maybe oversees a couple tents. Because I feel like if you have one counselor per tent, that's a lot of counselors.
But when you think about it, I'm not a parent, but I would assume that you want to make sure that these kids are safe. I mean, I don't know. To me, it just sounds like a little off of, like, how would you not have enough staff for each tent? So that's where, like, if their kids aren't supervised, even if, like, you could take your kid to the park, in a blink of an eye, your kid can be gone. You know, and I think it's just, like, a little bit irresponsible, because at least from when I remember what camp was, is that there was, like, adults and counselors keeping an eye on us. Mm-hmm. And so you even had to check in to, like, go to the bathroom. So we didn't stay, like, overnight, but it was, like, for 8 hours.
Yeah.
But I think if you're staying overnight and leaving your kid to go somewhere, you'd expect there to be just all someone eyes on that kid.
Yeah.
Because if these kids, your youngest Girl Scout is 8 years old, I mean, come on. Like, I don't know. I don't think I'd let my kid
stay. I guess you make a valid point there. I guess I was just thinking in just general terms, I guess, from how I see camps and counselors and stuff like that off of movies and TV, but I have never been.
I don't know. I think for me, it's just, I guess I was just like, the way that we were raised is like, my mom was like strict and just had all eyes on us. My grandma like would be spying out the window and we would walk home from school too and like be like, where are you? Who's she with? Like, so I don't know. It's just a little off to me that they wouldn't have a counselor outside each tent or like right next to it.
Yeah.
Because they like all the tents were like scattered.
See, that's what I would think. I would think there'd be one counselor.
There wasn't,
overseeing,
though.
Like, maybe, I don't know, 5-6 tents, and each tent had, like, 4 kids in it or something.
To me, it's just, like, a little suspect that you wouldn't have enough supervision for every tent.
Makes sense.
Anyway, so, Michelle, Denise, and Lori were inside tent number 8. And they were comforting each other, and they were writing letters to their parents while the storm was going on. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a background on these 3 young girls. So Lori was the youngest girl at camp, and she was excited to meet the other girls. She had 4 siblings and was a daughter to Dr. Charles Farmer and Sherry. Lori was indecisive about whether to attend Girl Scout camp or the camp that was sponsored by the YMCA. Her mother decided Lori would go to Girl Scout camp, and it's something that her mom regretted. So isn't it weird that the little girl didn't want to go?
She already had some type of sense about something wrong was going to happen?
Yeah.
Like, just a bad feeling of camp? Well, I guess they could be like for any kid, right? I mean, if they've never been to camp before, right? To them, it's like an unknown thing, and maybe they just don't want it. They don't want to do something else with their summer. The parents are really the ones that want to get rid of the kids.
But I think in the world we live in, I just think that just have an open heart and listen. And maybe that's just a sign, right?
Yeah.
Of like, hey, why doesn't my kid want to go? Like, just try to be comforting. Well, what do I know? I'm not an expert. It's just, yeah, I think for me, that was just like a sign, hey, maybe you shouldn't let her go.
Yeah.
But, okay. So, there, one of the letters that was found inside the tent was Lori. So she actually wrote this letter to her family. And then this was the last time that anyone would ever hear from her. So this is what the letter said. Quote, "Dear Mom and Dad and Misty and Joe and Chad and Kathy, we're just getting ready to go to bed. It's 7:45. We're at the beginning of a storm and having a lot of fun. I've met 2 new friends, Michelle Goose and Denise Milner. I'm sharing a tent with them. It started raining on the way back from dinner. We're sleeping on cots. I couldn't wait to write. We're all writing letters now because there's hardly anything else to do. With love, Lori." End quote. So then, now going back to the background on the girls. Michelle attended camp in 1976, and she was excited to return. She was athletic, and she was fascinated with outdoor activities. And Denise's mother, Betty, said that her daughter was worried about going to camp, and she almost changed her mind, but her mother persuaded her to go. Denise excelled in school, and so she sold enough Girl Scout cookies to be able to attend camp. After the girls were done writing their letters, they went to sleep, and it continued to rain. Later that evening, one of the counselors that was in a nearby camp to Camp Kiowa noticed a light in the woods. The counselor grabbed a flashlight to see who it was, and it seemed that the light in the woods was moving towards Camp Kiowa. She thought nothing of it and figured it was one of the other counselors, and then she walked back to the tent. In Camp Kiowa, another counselor in tent number one woke up in the middle of the night because they heard weird noises. She did the same as the previous counselor and checked around Camp Kiowa to see who or what was making the sounds. She walked to a few tents and then the noises stopped. Then the counselor returns to her tent and goes to sleep. The following morning around 6 a.m., the counselor was on her way to the showers and she noticed a sleeping bag underneath a tree. So I do want to give a heads up that there will be a trigger and we will be talking about rape. And so I do apologize in advance. So she, when the counselor saw what was underneath the tree, she saw that it was a deceased body of a young girl inside of it. Just 300 feet away, there was two more sleeping bags and inside were lifeless bodies of the young girls. Michelle, Lori, and Denise were sexually assaulted, beaten, strangled, and murdered. After this grim discovery, the campers were sent back to the Girl Scout headquarters in Tulsa. So here's like the odd part is that Camp Scott first called their insurance company and an attorney before calling the girls' parents.
So they were more trying to cover themselves than even giving any warning.
Yes.
That's a bit strange.
And the girls' tent was covered in blood, and it seemed as if the murderer tried to clean up the crime with towels and a mattress cover. The killer left a footprint of a shoe outside of the tent, and then police found another print inside, but the prints didn't match.
So it could have been more than one person.
It's a possibility.
Unless someone was wearing two different pairs of shoes.
And I believe that one of the footprints was like a military style shoe.
Okay.
Additional evidence found on the scene consisted of fingerprints on the bodies, a cord, duct tape, and a red flashlight. And it was left on top of one of the bodies. Police interviewed camp staff and they realized that this wasn't a random crime, but it was planned in advance. 2 months before the murders, a camp counselor noticed that someone went through her belongings and ate a box of the donuts she had left out. She found a note inside the box that read, quote, "We are on a mission to kill three girls in tent one," end quote. The camp director didn't take the note seriously and thought it was a prank. Camp staff reported hearing strange sounds around Camp Scott within that same time frame.
That's weird.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't know why you wouldn't take like a note like that into consideration, knowing that you have a lot of young girls on site.
Yeah. I guess that was in the 70s too, right? I mean, now if you do that, you're getting flagged and notified almost instantly, right? That's not tolerable. It shouldn't have been tolerable back then, but in the 70s, I guess, were just a different time.
Something that I wonder is that if there's strange things going on, if the parents aren't informed about it.
I would hope, though. I would hope so, right? If you have someone even planning a note like this, you would think immediately the parents should be called. Like, who would leave a note like that?
I think I just have more questions right now. I'm like, what's going on here?
Yeah,
I want to go back in time. So anyway, police brought in canine dogs, and they found a crowbar, and they thought it could be the possible murder weapon. They found additional fingerprints on the crowbar, and there was no suspects named. The press did have a suspect in mind, and it was Gene Leroy Hart, and he was an escaped convict. So DA Sid Wise wanted to retract Sheriff Glenn Weaver's previous statements about the no murder weapon was found and that they had no suspects. Eventually, the murder weapon was found and it was an axe that belonged to the campsite.
That's terrible.
So canine dogs assisted police in finding caves that were 2 miles away from the camp, and it's highly likely that someone was living in it. And so, like, from the information that I went over, it seems that, like, someone was camping out in these caves, and there was also, like, items found in these caves that belonged to the campsite, Camp Scott.
Okay. So someone took the materials, went into the cave, and was just kind of staking out there. That's a shame. That's horrible. I hope they caught this person.
So eyeglasses that were taken from the camp were found, duct tape, batteries, and 2 pictures of 3 women that Gene was affiliated to were inside that cave. The caves were close to the home that Gene grew up in. In a different cave nearby, they found writing that read, quote, "The killer was here. Bye-bye, fools." And then they wrote the number 77-6-17, end quote.
What did that stand for?
So I'm assuming that that was like the date. June 17th of 1977 is what I gathered from that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So when the bodies were examined, a strand of hair was found on one of them, and it didn't belong to any of the girls. The strand of hair was traced back to Gene Hart. He was a Cherokee and was convicted for kidnapping and raping 2 pregnant women in 1966. He escaped Mays County Jail and he was a fugitive since 1973. Gene was allegedly seen on the Camp Scott grounds and was also familiar with the area. So because the evidence was linked to Hart, the search for him began. There were helicopters, air surveillance, SWAT teams, and hundreds of volunteers searching for Gene, but he continued to avoid law enforcement. Cherokees and other Native Americans in the region worried that Gene was wrongfully targeted because of his race. Gene had the opportunity to turn himself in, but he didn't and instead was being protected by Sam Pigeon. Gene was on the run until April 6th of 1978, when agents from the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation raided Sam's home due to a tip they had received. OSBI arrested Gene and transported him to Oklahoma State Penitentiary. Sam Pigeon was charged for concealing a fugitive. During Gene's trial, he was receiving support from the Cherokee community and donations were being gathered that would go towards Gene's defense. The prosecution mentioned that the evidence found at Sam Pigeon's home, which were a mirror and a corncob pipe that were taken from Camp Scott, as well as a strand of hair that was similar to Gene's. Gene's defense pointed out a different suspect, William Stevens, who was a convicted rapist. So a waitress that worked in a cafe that was 15 miles away from Camp Scott came forward and identified William Stevens. She had seen William in the cafe on the morning the 3 young girls were murdered. The waitress stated that William was in the cafe between 5 a.m. to 6 a.m. and he seemed nervous. Another witness was an 11-year-old scout from the camp, and she recalls seeing William on Camp Scott grounds days before the murders. Other witnesses that came forward during the trial remember that the red flashlight found at the scene was the one they gave to William and his friend Dwayne Peters weeks before the murders. Dwayne Peters told investigators that one day, while him and William had one too many drinks in October of 1977, William confessed that he was responsible for the murders of the girls at Camp Scott. Allegedly, Dwayne says William was working on an oil rig near Camp Scott and he was familiar with the area and knew when the Girl Scouts would be at camp. He supposedly set up surveillance and used methods he had picked up during his service in Vietnam. He targeted the tent that was more secluded and planned his attack. William denied these allegations and insisted that he didn't know the area. Investigators collected blood and semen samples from the men and it ruled them out as suspects. When Gene was on trial, he was found not guilty by the jury, but he did receive jail time for the crimes he had done in the past. In June of 1979, he had a heart attack and died. There were theories that pointed to other suspects like Sonny James and Frank Justice. Frank was an alcoholic and was arrested in the past for crimes he committed. In 1990, he was interviewed and asked where he was on the night of the Girl Scout murders and didn't want to cooperate. Sonny was Frank's nephew and also had a criminal history. William Stevens ended his own life at Kansas State Penitentiary in 1984. The murders of Lori, Michelle, and Doris remain unsolved.
I don't know how safe that campground seems when you have all these people nearby, right, with alcohol problems and with these past committed crimes that they've done. That, I think, should have been disclosed to the parents beforehand. But I guess maybe they didn't know. That's scary. That's a scary thought. You know, you send your children to camp and who knows, right? What other people who work there are, you know, what their backgrounds are. That's a terrible thought.
I guess it seems like what you don't know won't hurt you. And the less you know, it won't hurt you. And I think, at least in my opinion, is that a lot of things were just thrown under the rug. Mm-hmm. I think that it's a possibility that it was more than one person that committed the crime. There was an article somewhere that I read that there was a possibility that a female was involved as well. So I wasn't... The website was like a little sketch, and I'm like, I don't know if this is credible, but on the article I read that they found a female's DNA on one of the pillows in the girl's tent. And it didn't belong to
one of those girls.
Anyone. And it didn't belong to the little girls. But there wasn't like consistency in like the other articles that I read with that information. Mm-hmm. But like a lot of people also are saying that it seems like it was more than one person involved.
Well, it seemed like it, right? Because there were two different footprints found originally.
Yeah. And I don't know. I think I don't trust the camp. I don't trust the camp counselors and the people running.
Well, yeah, the camp since they didn't even contact the parents first. They were finding ways to cover their end first. It shows where their interests really laid, right? They didn't even care about calling the family first. They're like, okay, how are we going to recover from this first?
Yeah, I think it's important to let the parents know first. But I don't know. I think I'm like a little sus, like as far as what if someone from Camp Scott was involved and got away with murder?
It could very well be a possibility. It's surprising because I thought they were leading up to a suspect and a conviction, but it ended up being false.
Yeah. It's
someone knew something, I think.
Yeah, but I mean...
And it's just, there's no motive, right? And obviously there's no killer, right? So they don't have, the motive's unknown. But it's disturbing to me why someone would even want to come in, find these young girls in a tent, and want to have killed them.
Maybe, I think it was someone that had a criminal history was involved, and then another individual, this is just my theory, and then someone else that didn't have a criminal history assisted with the murders. And I mean, I just don't think the DNA was that evolved back then. Mm-hmm. And now I mean, with the evidence that they collected, I'm just not sure as to how that would work with, like, examining the evidence once again and testing and things like that. Because it's really the evidence is really old.
Right. Yeah, I don't know if you can, how that works. That's even possible. That's unfortunate, though. Yeah. You know, rest in peace to these three little girls who had their lives taken such a short notice by monsters.
It's disgusting. Like, it is. You took their lives away, you hurt the families. So, Josh, what is going on with the Finders cult conspiracy?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, let me try and break it down in the easiest way that I can after watching and listening and reading multiple files of information. And this is a big story here. And I guess before I get started, as you did, I'll give a trigger warning here, as there is mention of, supposed child abuse, Satanism, you name it. I mean, this is a crazy story. So I'll just kind of walk you through it, and hopefully everyone here follows along. So in 2018, the FBI released over 300 pages of documents pertaining to a group called the Finders, who were an organization based in Washington, D.C., and they had allegations of Satan worship and child pornography. Now, not a whole lot of information is really widely known or even talked about this organization prior to 1987. But even then, to this day, it's still a rarely discussed topic. You don't really hear much about it. And all of this really started with just one concerned phone call to the Tallahassee police in 1987. Little did anyone know at this time that this phone call would begin one of the largest conspiracy theories pertaining to the government's involvement in child sex abuse and satanic culturists. Some people even gone the lengths of calling this group, the Finders, as patient zero for the likes of Jeffrey Epstein and the Comet Ping Pong Pizzagate scandal. And if you're not familiar with that, that was in 2016, where there were several online forums, such as Twitter and 4chan, that suspected various Democratic Party members of being involved in a child trafficking ring. And, now a lot of these reports have, you know, stated that this whole theory has been debunked, but that's kind of where Pizzagate came in. That was also in relation to, like, Hillary Clinton having her emails leaked, and there were a lot of weird references to pizza, but people thought pizza was, like, a code word for child. And a bunch of different high government ranking officials. I don't know if
you... And Hillary's emails?
Hillary Clinton was one of them. There were a few other top, like, political figures that had their emails, and there were just weird instances of, like, pizza being mentioned, and people were quick to believe that pizza was some type of innuendo for children.
Josh, I'm shook because I think I vaguely remember that happening, but I ignored it. But I think it'd be interesting to look into that, because why would you use the word pizza?
It's very strange. It's ridiculous. There's different videos and different, you know, articles online, yeah. And it sounds strange, right? And then another one, right, is Jeffrey Epstein, who was a financier who had ties to some of these high-ranking officials, both in politics, royalty, and even some famous celebrities. He was arrested in July of 2019 on conspiracies to engage in sex trafficking, but he did die in jail by suicide only a month after his capture. And that case is still ongoing. But this group, the Finders, was almost kind of like, you know, not the predecessor, but it predates these two instances. It's almost like the beginnings of it.
Right.
So in the late 1980s, there was this phenomenon going on called the Satanic Panic, which was, you know, in the 80s, you had the rise of, death metal music and music with hidden subliminal messages. video games and movies had more depictions of demons and devils and horror movies, and there was a rise of satanic cults and rituals going on in the news, and it was just causing mass hysteria. That was what the satanic panic was. Now, on February 4th, 1987, a woman called the Tallahassee, Florida Police Department after witnessing two well-dressed men in suits overseeing and playing in a local park with six young children. Now, the children were between the ages of 2 and 7 and were severely unkempt, wearing dirty clothes with various insect bites. And it appeared that the children hadn't bathed in days. Like, these kids were just dirty. When the police arrived, they questioned the two men, and the two men reported that they were the children's teachers and that they were driving to a school in Mexico for brilliant children. When questioned about the whereabouts of the children's mothers, the two men had replied that they were being weaned off from their mothers, that they were, you know, trying to get them to not be so dependent on the moms.
So the moms basically gave up the rights to the children?
I'll get to that. So police also noticed that the two men had a Dodge minivan. When the police inspected it, they noticed that the minivan had a foul smell, and they found items such as books, letters, a computer, and even a mattress inside. It was apparent to the police that it looked like the six children were living in that van. The two men were later identified as Michael Houlihan, 23, and Douglas Ammerman, 27. And both were arrested on misdemeanor charges of child abuse and held on a bond of $100,000 at the Leon County Jail. Now, police were unable to locate the mothers of each of the children at that time, and each child had been given a fake name. Police took the children and placed them into state custody. According to the police, 5 out of the 6 children were unable to communicate properly. They just didn't have the proper skills, and they were not able to recognize many common items such as electricity and even hot water. They couldn't tell you what it was. Now, the oldest child in the group was a girl who went by the name of Mary, and she was able to articulate a little bit, and so she was able to give police a few answers to some of their questions. Now, what Mary said to the police is kind of disturbing in itself.
Oh, man, let me get ready.
So Mary had confirmed to the police that the two men were, in fact, her teachers, but she was unsure of where they were actually going. She had no idea where their destination was going to be. She was also given several various last names to go by and didn't know which one to use. So when the cops asked her what her full name was, she simply just said, "Well, which one do I give you?" She didn't know what her actual name was.
Oh my God, poor child. Like, you just don't know how to identify. You're just confused.
Yeah. Well, she was 7. She was the oldest one, I think. Yeah. So she said that she had also once lived in a house in Washington, D.C., and that there were other children and adults present. She was only fed a diet of raw food and vegetables and was really only given some of this food as a reward. She also said that she was taught on how to, quote unquote, play games by a person called the Game Caller, who this would later turn out to be a man by the name of Miriam Petit. Now, after Mary had given the police these, you know, these responses and these answers, authorities in Tallahassee, you know, went straight to the authorities in Washington, D.C. and contacted them in an attempt to get more information on the children, since Mary had said that she had, you know, lived in a house there with other children and adults. Now, surprisingly, Washington police were already aware of a group and identified them as, you know, these children belonging to a group called the Finders. Now, it was reported by a confidential source to the Washington police that the Finders were a cult and that they conducted brainwashing techniques at both a warehouse and a duplex apartment in the area. So they had been already, you know, there had already been police in Washington, D.C. kind of doing undercover investigations on this group.
So before the woman called the police?
Before the woman called police, because that was in Tallahassee.
Right.
In Florida.
Okay.
So prior to that, I mean, there was already kind of a mid-investigation going on this group in Washington, D.C.
Gotcha.
So the finders were reported to have recruited members with the promise of a financial reward and sexual gratification, and they were often given the chance to explore Satanism. Another location for the finders' alleged whereabouts was traced to a 90-acre farm in Culpeper, Virginia, and that 90-acre farm was registered and owned by a man by the name of Miriam Petit through evidence that was found on a computer inside the Dodge minivan in Tallahassee, Florida. So police had visited all three locations and found that the warehouse and the apartment duplex had their windows boarded shut and were padlocked. Police had found newspapers scattered inside various rooms, along with books and even a world map. To their surprise, bags of photographs were also discovered there, and some included photos of children, like school photos, and even some photos of naked children, and even a photo of a child in chains and what was believed to be some type of ritual with three men in the background in white robes and two slaughtered goats.
What the hell?
It gets very bizarre. So as police were investigating these two locations, of course, they went and asked the neighbors of both the warehouse and the apartment, for any kind of clues or any type of information from what they've noticed. And the neighbors have claimed to have seen two out of the six children found in Tallahassee and recognized them and claimed, they've seen those children go in and out of the building, but they've only seen men present. They've never saw any women go in and out of that building. Now, neighbors of the Virginia farm claim to have heard children screaming and hollering from that location as if they were being hurt or if they wanted something. And they've reportedly seen vans going in and out of the location, too, with children inside. So Tallahassee police were contacted by a man who went by the name of Robert Terrell. He was a person who was associated and a part of the group called the Finders. And he was able to clear up any of the suspicious findings.
So, Josh, So if the neighbors supposedly heard children screaming and hollering, did they ever think to call police?
No. But I guess that could be anything, right? I guess I'm thinking, if I heard a children screaming and hollering next door, maybe my initial thought would be it's a baby, right? And the kid wants something, right? I guess your first thought isn't that anything crazy is happening, unless you have some real suspicions about it.
But you only see men, and you know what? Like, I understand that there's some single fathers out there. Mm-hmm. I get it. But if you see only men and no women, it's a little sus, I think.
That would be sus.
So now if you didn't hear screaming and hollering, I'm like, all right. But it's like, if you only see men.
Well, let me clear that up, because their neighbors had reportedly only seen men coming in and out of the duplex apartment and in the warehouse location. At the 90-acre farm, I guess there was no mention of what types of adults were seen on premises.
Okay.
At the 90-acre farm, it was only stated that, neighbors could hear, I guess, from the distance, right, the wailing or screaming of children.
I don't know. It's just really weird to me. Like,
it's gonna
neighbors aren't woke.
It's going to get a bit weirder as we continue on. So as I had mentioned, Robert Terrell, he was a part of the Finders, and he managed to contact the Tallahassee police because he wanted to, address some of the suspicious findings and wanted to, provide cover up.
Like, it's all good type of deal.
Yeah. So he dismissed any involvement with the Finder's teachings involving satanic influence and said simply that the media just blindly believed it because of this whole satanic panic, right, that was going on during this time. If there was something crazy, people just were quick to say, oh, that's it. He sent the Tallahassee police a memo detailing a lot of their misunderstandings. He claimed that both Michael Houlihan and Douglas Ammerman and the six children were on their way to Berea, Kentucky, to establish a retirement community, but for reasons unspecified, their trip was delayed, and then they decided to go to Florida with the approval of their mothers for a quick vacation. For the naked photos of the children found in the warehouse in Washington, D.C., they were found to with a reason to be acceptable, as two of the children turned out to be related to one of the two men, either Michael or Douglas Ammerman, and it was just written off as a common thing to have, for a parent to have a naked photo of their child.
Is it really? Oh my goodness.
They say if you guys take a photo of your child when he's little in a bathtub or something like that, they wrote it off as being, that's acceptable.
I mean, I'm trying to put myself in that, back in that time. And those are just some odd pictures. I remember, like, when I was little, that my mom would take pictures of us in, like, the little tub, mm-hmm. but would cover the private areas. And I think I've seen people on Instagram cover their child's areas. And yeah. Not that, I mean, I wouldn't post a picture of my kid like that or have that, you know. It's weird.
It is strange. Yeah. I mean, I definitely wouldn't be quick to say, you know, that's a, oh yeah, that makes sense.
I wouldn't be quick. Like, this is just so uncomfortable to me. Like,
it's very disturbing. So, where did I leave off here? Okay, so Robert Terrell, he also had reason to explain for the photo with the goats that were slaughtered and simply stated that it was just a common trade. And that they wanted their kids to be able to learn how to do that task. All of the children's parents were also a part of the Finder's cult, with members located in both Miami and Tampa. So when questioned, right, where the six children's parents were, they were all a part of this group. So it was established that the Finders were, in fact, some type of group forming together, right? But they were all part of it. And it's kind of like that was their movement. But they were trying to deny any, you know, satanic worship or child abuse. The group's leader was a man by the name of Myriam Petit, and he was a retired Air Force sergeant who originally started the Finders Group in the late 1960s. He wanted to teach people the quote-unquote New Age way of living. He wanted to start a new generation of children that would be raised by the group and not by their original parents.
What?
Yeah. With no known record of child abuse or Satanism. After that, court judges dropped all of the suspicion and charges of the group, and both Houlihan and Ammerman were let go free. And all the local news coverage at the time was gone just as quickly as it came.
So, hear me out here. I think, obviously, we have parents. Mm-hmm. And I think from the things that I remember is that, I was raised by a single mother, but you need that, like, love and care from that person that brought you into the world. And you need to be held, they need to feed you. If you're sick, they take care of you. But that's because that human being gave you life. And like being raised by a stranger just in my head doesn't seem like it's normal. Unless you've been given up to like for adoption and you're unable to care for the child and you find other means. But in my head, it's just like the psychological trauma that this kid doesn't know how to identify themselves or who they are. And they're just bringing them to a new group.
That's what's strange. I mean, one person, this guy, Marion Petit, had this idea of how he wanted, you know, people to think, and he was able to find people, brainwash them. And they were definitely accused of brainwashing people, right? Saying, hey, if you do this, we'll give you this, right? And people were quick to follow it. And then it just snowballed into, you know, a few people here, a few people there, and then their children were just brought into it. And that's how it led to be. So, Robert Terrell, right, came in, cleared up all these weird instances, and just like that, it was accepted, and the two men who had the six children were just let go.
This dropped all charges.
Now, there's some discrepancies that were later found, and this is where it gets even stranger. So, there were some inconsistencies with the report that Robert Terrell told, as originally, when Houlihan and Ammerman were arrested by the police in Tallahassee, Florida, remember, they originally mentioned that they were going to a school for brilliant children in Mexico.
Right.
With no mention of this retirement community in Kentucky, where Terrell said that they were originally going.
So they didn't get their story straight.
Right. So that's one. But no one caught that. No one caught that originally. The mother of the children were found, and the mothers had reportedly said that the children, while being a part of the finders group, were well kept and safe. But that also contradicts the fact that the children who were found in Tallahassee were reportedly dirty and appeared to be unbathed for several days. Special Agent Martinez and Detective Bradley had inspected the warehouse in D.C. and reportedly found a bunch of children's clothing and toys present. Paperwork was also found on the scene detailing instructions for obtaining children, either by purchasing or kidnapping, and the impregnation of other finders members.
What does that mean?
That means that they were basically the men or women who were part of that finders group were given instructions to create within one another. Right?
Okay.
A computer was also found at the location, and forensics records found an order for the purchasing of two children from Hong Kong that was supposedly arranged at the Chinese embassy. Along with the searches for evasion of law enforcement, bank secrecy, and even a detailed summary of Houlihan and Ammerman and their arrest situation in Tallahassee, which only occurred the night before. Right? So how did the information get from Tallahassee to Washington, D.C. in less than 24 hours?
It takes time, right?
Yeah, I mean, the computers were around, right? But who was communicating? Other files found were that of nude photographs of children that appeared to be on display. Adults and children engaged in what was believed to be a blood ritual, with goats being dismembered by the children. So photographs of all this were found, right? And all this was found, but it was not disclosed until after both Houlihan and Ammerman were let go for reasons unknown. Traces of the finder's activities were linked around the world in various parts of London, Germany, Costa Rica, Africa, Hong Kong, Malaysia, and many more countries.
So they probably had other members in those other parts of the world. And so it's possible that the group was bigger.
Exactly.
Than they thought it was.
Yep. That's the belief. So After finding all of this information, Agent Martinez was set to meet with Detective Bradley to go over his findings. This is prior to Houlihan and them letting go. But learned that Bradley was unavailable and told by another third party that the investigation was now to be handed over to the CIA. The information was now labeled as classified and held in secrecy. And the FBI, who Agent Martinez and Detective Bradley were a part of, were withdrawn from the investigation. But unfortunately, no further outcome or action was taken, even up until this day. In 2017, the Tallahassee Police Department finally posted online more information and more classified documents that brings much more of this story into much more suspicion.
So, why was this handed over to the CIA?
In 1987, there was no reason. They found all this additional information, and then all of a sudden, it's like, okay. They weren't given an explanation. They just said, you guys are off this case, and now it's going to be held by the CIA.
I hope nobody comes after us, but unless the CIA knew someone or knew people from the group, this is what I can just assume.
Well, here we go. And there's another part to this. So right in 1987, the case moves to the CIA. And after that, no further outcome or action was taken, right? And Houlihan and Ammerman were let go. That was it. Now, fast forward to 2017, the Tallahassee Police Department, as I mentioned, they posted online and they revealed more information that makes this story a lot more suspect, because now there was more information that wasn't available back then, available now. So according to the documents, it listed a man by the name of Detective Skip Clemens, and it was noted, right, that the operation had on the finders had now become a CIA operation. And this was because one of the members of the finders was employed as a part-time accountant at a computer training school named Future Enterprises, Inc., where CIA operatives received their computer training during the 1980s. While the CIA denied any involvement with the finders, it was found on a customs report that the CIA had communication with a quote-unquote finders corp for computer training operations, but notes that the training went bad.
That's it?
And that's it. That's all the available information currently out there. If you look through some of the documents, there is a bit, I mean, I say that this is all of it, right? But this is a very condensed version of the story. There is some more information on it, but it leads to this conspiracy where now, did the finders, one, exactly who were they? What did they do? What was their actual beliefs? Did they really have some type of partake in satanic rituals? Was there actual allegations of child and sex abuse? And now, for no real unknown reason, it being handed off as a CIA investigation, but now they find out that one of the members was in fact responsible for some computer training,
right,
done with CIA agents. It's just a weird coincidence.
It's all intermingled.
Yeah, it's very strange. So that's kind of where, that's where the conspiracy lays. Is this a bigger thing that we don't know about?
So it's as if, like, this investigation hasn't been put on top of the files, and it's just swept under and under. And it's like, oh, why look at it, is what it seems like to me.
Yeah. And this is what's crazy, right? Because even still right now, we have the Jeffrey Epstein case. I mean, his counterpart, I can't think of that woman's name, Ghislaine Maxwell, that's it. I mean, I don't think anyone's really heard her side of the story yet or what information she has to divulge, but, you know, her and Jeffrey Epstein, they've been accused right now, allegedly, right, of having this giant sex trafficking ring with a lot of high, powerful people. And could this be a part of this, you know, this giant secret organization where people are being trafficked? It's mind-blowing. It's disgusting. It's mind-blowing, but...
But did you mention that these kids were, in fact, abused?
Well, the fact that the kids had been kept very unkept, and they were dirty, and I know I've mentioned that, but I mean, there's a bit more to the story, but this is, like I said, a condensed version. If you look at some of the articles online, you will find that not until years later, they did mention that, you know, the van where the six children were kept, condoms were found. There have been some more photos of just naked children in, you know, in certain positions. It just looked very bad. So it did appear evident that there was some proof of, you know, child sexual abuse. But for the most part, it's really just come down to allegations. There's been no exact way to prove it. The information says that they found it, but there's been no real case made against it because someone shut it down somewhere. And that's part of the conspiracy of this.
So, like, what can we do to change this? Because let kids be kids. And I think hold your kids tight. Keep all eyes on them because you never know if that can be the last time.
Yeah, that's true. It's just a very scary thought, you know, that, you know, something like this could happen, that there's this potential secret organization, you know, controlling and brainwashing people or kids into doing these types of activities.
Well, we know that we covered some dark things today, and I think the purpose of this was to have you be more aware and just ask those questions and just watch who you trust.
Yeah. I mean, there's, again, it's a conspiracy, right? It's up to interpretation on what you think.
I think something's not right.
I agree. It doesn't feel comfortable with me.
Well, we appreciate everyone for tuning in, and don't forget to meet us here every Tuesday for a new episode and listen to us on your favorite podcast platform. And we'd appreciate if you're on Apple Podcasts to give us a review, show us some love, help our algorithm, tell your family and friends, coworkers about Killer Crossroads Podcast. Follow us on Instagram on Killer Crossroads Podcast, and follow us on Twitter.
And that's Kill R Crossroads. Thanks again, everyone, and we'll catch you in the next one.
Sending some love. Bye.
Bye.